coffee. It's not just good for monitoring seismic activity during a nuclear crisis. It's also a delicious, stimulating beverage. But not all coffee is created equal. And when you're done watching for tremors and you're ready to drink your coffee, you deserve the best. So switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and your next new favorite. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries and never run out of fresh coffee again. And Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So, what are you waiting for? Life is short. Drink better coffee. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome to the next 157 Project, the Monday Morning Classic Movies Podcast. We got this thing started in 2013 by chronicling the 123 motion pictures on the 1998 and 2007 lists of American Film Institute's great movies, and every last one of those episodes is available for free. If spoilers make you want to shoot a hero in the back, you best trundle on out of here. I'm the stuck valve who nearly caused a meltdown, Ryan Ellis. And here's the money grubber who gave the order to scram the son of a bitch, my wife Bev.
That's me.
I'm the control rod, she's the coolant. Whatever that means. All these nuclear terms. All right then, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The China Syndrome. The nuclear power plant in the movie is supposed to be just outside of Los Angeles. Where approximately would the nuclear core end up if it really did burrow through the earth and come out the other side?
It would come up in the Indian Ocean, not far off the coast of Madagascar, which is very far from China.
Right. So if it went straight through, of course.
Yeah.
But the China Syndrome sounds cooler.
Yeah, and I think everyone just has this notion that China's on the other side of the earth. If you look at a globe, and if you were to just vivisect it straight across without going through the core, then you might hit China. But if you're going through the core, I think they even say in the movie, oh, and you go through the core and you keep going. Well, then no, you're nowhere near China.
Well, could a meltdown really go right through the earth?
No, it
because of both gravity and it's a molten core that's way hotter than even a nuclear power plant. Whatever you call that stuff, the core, whatever, you know, a lot of cores here.
The name of the syndrome is obviously hyperbolic, but I think that it's trying to convey the extremeness of the situation. This is an unstoppable thing. I have to say, this movie did actually educate me to what a meltdown is.
It's a procedural that really does educate you. It's true for most of us who wouldn't have known anything about this kind of stuff. We don't know if the plant really is based on reality. It's one of those movies that I'm sure they studied power plants as much as they could. They probably didn't get a lot of access, and this movie was nominated for its sets. But it seems pretty real from what I would ever know about a power plant. The Simpsons also seem pretty real for a power plant. All right, so the Madagascar Syndrome was released a little over 40 years ago by Columbia on March 16th, 1979. Considering the terrifyingly real subject matter, the picture did very well at the box office. It made over $50 million in 1979, which is $185 million adjusted for inflation on a budget of about $6 million. One of the reasons why, if you know anything about this movie, you've probably heard this story before, 12 days after it got released, Three Mile Island near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania happened. And it was not intentional, of course, by the filmmakers. People said, "Whoa, did Hollywood do that?" Yeah, Hollywood's going to risk people's lives to promote a movie. The big thing about, by the way, a meltdown happening, and even going into the earth really at all, is it pollutes the groundwater. Contaminates that, which is what they're trying to do, not with nuclear stuff, but what they're trying to do in The Dark Knight. Sorry, not Dark Knight. Batman Begins. They want to turn the water into a fear toxin. Now, that's not what would happen with this, but that's the point. You pollute groundwater to that level, you might hurt or even kill an awful lot of people. All right, Bev, you better explain what this old movie is about with the China Syndrome skinny.
Jane Fonda is Kimberly Wells, an ambitious human interest field reporter whose fluff piece about a local power plant turns into a close encounter with a near meltdown. When the plant tries to bury the story, Kimberly finds an ally in power plant company man Jack Goodell, played by Jack Lemmon, who walked away from the incident ready to blow the whistle on the plant's lax safety precautions.
Before that, he was a company man. In honor of Glengarry Glen Ross, which, of course, Lemon is in and is great in. Or, in a nutshell, in a shocking twist, aging white man only trusts the media. He'll only talk to Kimberly. Or...
Nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear.
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 It's become a thing with me lately, playing clips live here rather than actually downloading them. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers for China Syndrome. 84% of critics like this movie. 26 fresh, only 5 rotten, for an average of 7.53 out of 10, which is a very strong number. And 81% of audiences. It got 4 Oscar nominations. I mentioned the sets already. It was also nominated for Lemon as Best Actor, who lost out to Dustin Hoffman. That was a great year for actors, actually. Peter Sellers was nominated for Being There as well that year. Strong group. And Jane Fonda for Best Actress, who'd won the year before, her second time for Coming Home, so she wasn't going to win again. And then the original screenplay by the director and a bunch of other guys. And it won the WGA Award. And often that is a precursor, as much as any other award is, to winning an Oscar, but not that time. China Syndrome is also 94th on the Top 100 Thrills list. Psycho was number one. And it was also nominated for the AFI's Top 50 Heroes. Jack Goodell, who was a hero, as so well said by Wilford Brimley at the end of the film. And he would have been an interesting choice because there aren't a lot of people like him who are very average dudes who are portrayed by his own company as a crazy man. But he is a hero. He's trying to do the right thing. And in the end, if you think about it, he's going to get what he wants because there'll finally be an investigation after what's going on here. The media won't let this one go by. Not just Kimberly Station, but all of them are there. They'll finally do something about this and maybe even bury that plant. All right, what'd you think of this movie, which I believe it was your first time ever seeing it, right?
Yeah, it was. I actually knew very little about it. It is a great movie. Technically, unimpeachable. Script is a masterclass in tension building without ever succumbing to melodrama. The direction keeps a perfect tone, never lets us look away. But the real MVPs are Jane Fonda and Jack Lemmon, who are incredible, and they just totally prove that grounded, realistic reactions to crisis are far more effective than hyperbolic drama. What's scarier than a blustered nuclear technician who's suddenly stunned into silence? This movie proves very few things.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned it most on the Thrills list. It could have been even higher.
It's so legitimately scary because of its verisimilitude.
This may be one of Lemon's 3 or 4 best performances. He's best known for his comedy, Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, where AFI films, we covered those a long time ago. I mentioned Glengarry Glen Ross, which you don't like, but I love. That's a drama mostly, especially his scenes in it. This is definitely way up there as far as his best performances, although he's not really in the movie much in the first or third acts. He's more in the second, when it is truly a procedural. We're really watching minutia. They could be making it up, for all we know, and maybe they did make a lot of it up, although I'm guessing the director, James Bridges, and his 2 co-writers, because he wrote the film as well, did a lot of research on this and learned what they possibly could about nuclear reactors. But if they're faking it, the actors, the filmmakers, everybody, they're pretty convincing fakers.
And it doesn't really matter if they get all the details right, considering that the vast majority of their audiences are not going to understand, and that's not really what's important. Because we all know that nuclear power plants inherently have a certain amount of danger. But we try not to think about it on a daily basis. And I'm never going to understand exactly how they work. But if people don't dot their I's and cross their T's, if bureaucrats are more afraid of getting caught than they are afraid of killing half of California, then we have a problem.
Well, the plant's not ready to reopen, but fuck it. Cover it up and let's get her done.
It's very much reminding me of Jaws. The mayor in Jaws.
We have caught and killed a large power plant that supposedly injured some bathers. Not quite the same thing. This movie had a ton of working titles because the China Syndrome, which actually is a pretty cool sounding name now, I think. But it could have been called What Price Power? Chain Reaction, which That's is a movie one. That Keanu was in. Was it Nuclear Power? I don't remember that movie. I saw it a long time ago. And this is also pretty generic, but it's a little more specific. Evented Ventana, because that's where it is. The Ventana Power Plant. Which provides power for 750,000 people. And the director, James Bridges, points out that the irony is that all these people benefit in that area from the nuclear power. And also the TV station that's going to out the story, the TV stations at the end of the movie, also benefit, as we all do, from power.
Mm-hmm.
And there's got to be a way we get this other than just burning coal and old dinosaurs as oil. It's a very sunny movie because it is set in SoCal. All that sun in so many parts of the world, but especially in Southern California, why were we not doing solar a long time ago with all that sun beating down on the earth every single day somewhere, even when it's not sunny, you can get some solar power out of what's coming, because the sun's still shining. It's just maybe not getting through the same way. Why weren't we doing something about that a long time ago? Well, we all know the answer.
Well, I think in the 70s, the technology legitimately just wasn't there yet.
But we could have been pursuing it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Certainly there should have been more investment in it. We'd be in less of a pickle now.
The nuclear power industry were not fans of this movie, which is not surprising. And then, as I mentioned, not even 2 weeks later, Three Mile Island happens. Poor Harrisburg. We are currently watching, we've only seen two episodes so far, but of Chernobyl.
Yeah, I'm against nuclear power now. I never really gave it much thought before, but good lord, the stakes are high.
If they ever could have made it safe, and I don't think it's even possible, doesn't look like it is, but if they could have, it would have been a great way for us to get all of our power, because it is a renewable resource. We could use it just like we could the sun and the wind, but we could fuel so many areas with nuclear power. But we see with Fukushima a couple years ago when they had that typhoon. That's even more serious because I haven't really heard that much.
It's a tsunami, not a typhoon.
Sorry. Tsunami then. But we find out what happens when something like that can be exposed. I don't know what the long-term ramifications have been. Maybe no one does yet. Chernobyl, of course, Three Mile Island.
Fukushima is a great example because Fukushima is a plant where arguably they did everything right, but nobody anticipated a 10 on the Richter scale earthquake. It was an unprecedented earthquake that they didn't prepare for it to be that bad. And it just goes to show freak events are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Whether it be human error, whether it be something as simple as one of the monitors was glitchy.
Well, it's that's a stuck valve.
That's just what's going to happen. When you have as many nuclear power plants as there are in the world, it is a statistical
inevitability.
Inevitability, thank you, that something like this is going to go wrong, or there's going to be a crazy once in 500 years earthquake. And regardless, even if you have a power plant that's really well managed now, well, who knows what could happen to your country and to the government and to the bureaucracy. There's no assurance that it won't be mismanaged in the future. And these are things that need to be managed for many years into the future, because the nuclear waste is always a problem for generations.
Yeah. Where do you put it all? Of course, yeah. Yeah, the turbine trip that happens in the movie, Lemon explains that later on when he's going on and on. The stuck valve, a faulty relay, and that's all combined with human error. And the scene of quiet panic, which of course they are all sitting there waiting, oh my god, what's going to happen? And finally the water covers it and they're okay. And the way they react gives the game away to Michael Douglas, who's illegally filming this.
Because I didn't know really what was going to happen in the movie and where it was going to go. I genuinely didn't know if the movie was going to be about the fallout from a terrible nuclear accident. Mm-hmm. Maybe everybody in that room is ultimately doomed and it's about what happens afterwards. I didn't know that everything was going to be okay. So my tension watching that scene, it's intense.
I love how James Hampton, who was caretaker in The Longest Yard, Chris and I covered that movie a few months ago. Anyway, he's the tour guide for them, and he says, we're in one of the safe areas here. Safe area? If it wasn't an actual meltdown, it doesn't matter anyway. Supposedly safe areas. And Douglas is illegally filming. This character could have been played by one of your favorites, Richard Dreyfuss.
Well, I don't love Michael Douglas very much either, so...
But I thought he was good in this movie, with all that hair everywhere.
It's a good character for him because he's an antagonizing character. He's there because he has to be there, because you have to have somebody who's reckless and is going to take chances and just force the issue where everybody else is rule-following. So he's kind of there just to push the plot forward, although he pulls it off and he makes it seem natural.
He hadn't acted all that much before this movie. He was in the TV show Streets of San Francisco, which is where he made his name. Obviously, he made his name off his father, but he's one of these guys. We would know about him if he tried to get into acting, I think, regardless of his last name, because he's a talented guy. He always was. This was his first movie after producing, along with Saul Zantz, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They won the Oscar for that. And this wasn't nominated for Best Picture. It probably should have been. And maybe Best Director. And, well, you got the major ones with the actors and the screenplay, at least. I think he did a pretty good job of acting in this film, but it could have been Dreyfuss, Jack Nicholson in the Lemon role, and then I think Jane Fonda would have always had the Kimberly Wells role, because this is her project. She and Bruce Gilbert spearheaded some things in the late 70s. They did 9 to 5 after this. I think they did Coming Home the year before, the one that won the Oscar in 78. And then I think also On Golden Pond was effectively their project, or at least it was one of those things where they said, okay, we're going to put our weight behind this and our money and whatnot and shepherd it through. So in the span of about 4 years, she was involved in some pretty major films and some movies that got her an awful lot of acclaim, and of course the Oscar for Coming Home, and nominations for this and also for On Golden Pond. And people loved, and it was a big hit, 9 to 5.
If I was her, if I was any actress, actor, anybody involved in film, and a script like this landed on my desk, I'd probably want to make it my project too, because the script is phenomenal.
One thing I really like about this movie is the way they portray TV. Use TV lingo that most people would not understand, certainly not then, and maybe not even now, which Network did also several years before, one of the AFI's top 100 movies, one of my favorite comedies, or whatever you want to call it, satires. You can also see the origin of roll tape, because they actually had to roll tape back then, or roll commercial. We still say that now, FYI. We still say roll commercial and whatnot, even though there's no rolling. We push buttons completely. I don't think there's any rolling at all. Not in the CBC. And we also see something that undoubtedly still exists now, objectifying the good-looking news reporter right off the bat. And you hear a line that said, "She'll do what we tell her," which actually applies, I suppose, to all the journalists and reporters, but especially applies to her. They're all on-air performers now. Maybe they always were, but they really are just mostly performers now. You're the one that said Anderson Cooper maybe isn't as bright as everyone thinks he is.
Okay, you're outing me as an Anderson Cooper non-believer, but I think he's just good at appearing smart, and I say this because he was on Jeopardy once, and the lack of knowledge that he had for basic things about the world. This is a guy who's traveled everywhere, and he did not know geography, he didn't know world leaders, and he completely humiliated himself. You're just good at looking smart, and you and I both know, because we work with on-air personalities, a lot of them are genuinely smart, and a lot of them just have good poise and a great tone of voice. And are really good at reading scripts that other people write for
them. They're the William Hurt
yes.
of reality.
Almost
in broadcast
all the
news.
Time. They aren't writing their own scripts. There are exceptions. There are people who are really out there doing it themselves. But mostly, you specialize. You're either really good at appearing on camera or you're really good at producing a great field piece. But why does that have to be the same person? Very often it's not. Now, this is a movie about somebody who is that person.
She has substance.
She has substance. She seems to be producing her own stuff. She's very bright, and she's very ambitious. This movie's kind of categorized as a disaster film, but of course a disaster never really takes place. Really, it's a journalism film.
Yep,
it has a lot more in common with All the President's Men than with any disaster film that I can think of. I actually saw a great line from a review I read that said this was the best Sidney Lumet film not directed by Sidney Lumet.
Fair. Much like Dog Day Afternoon, there's no music score in the entire movie. There is some music, but you could argue it's just playing from the radio. When they're driving to Ventana at the very beginning, Douglas, his guy Hector, who's played by Daniel Valdez, and of course Jane Fonda, when they're driving to the plant, that's just on the radio supposedly.
Yeah,
there's
some
no other music.
Noise,
in the actual movie, no score, per se, and that's the same in Network.
And it bears a lot of similarities to Network, too. Yeah, there's obviously touches from that. Kimberly, the journalist, is inarguably the main character. TV business is as much a character in the film as the power plant, maybe even more when you consider the bookend open and close of the film, which are both these steady shots of the monitors of control room showing mechanisms of how TV news programs get made. And you and I can both attest, like we're saying, it's remarkably accurate. Mm-hmm. It feels very real about the way people talk to each other, the way people talk when no one can hear them. Yeah, they're objectifying Kimberly, but they're also talking about what kind of a job she's doing. Mm-hmm. And these are conversations I have heard. I've heard behind the scenes. People talk very honestly when they're in the edit suite. And they're just as likely to pay a compliment, whether it be about their looks or about the quality of their work, as they are to objectify them. And they do both in this. And it feels very realistic. The way she is on camera when she's waiting after that great line when she smokes a cigarette. I don't smoke.
Don't even smoke. Cut.
So she's a journalist getting her scoop. That's a great way to turn a story about social issues into a thriller, which it also is. We saw this with All the President's Men, Spotlight, The Insider. It provides a screenplay with this natural high-stakes conflict to frame the issue, and framing a film around a charismatic, good-looking advocate pursuing the truth is also an excellent way to make difficult subject matter that we'd usually prefer to avoid, like the inherent danger of nuclear power, highly palatable.
Al Pacino and Mark Ruffalo would appreciate you saying The Good Looking and The Insider and Spotlight.
Okay, that's fair. It's really true about John Syndrome, less so about those other two movies.
Well, Jane Fonda's got the red hair, which they also comment on, and that was not something she usually had. She would be a brunette mostly. I guess she probably was a blonde at times, too. I've said before that Jane Fonda in the 60s especially, along with Claudia Cardinale, we covered her just last week on Once Upon a Time in the West, two of the best-looking women I've ever seen. Their era in the 60s when they're around 30 years old each.
She's a screen presence to spare.
She is one of the great actresses. I think we talked about that when we did on Golden Pawn, and she's been given credit for that. She won the two Oscars. She was nominated a lot of times, though it's been a long time since she was nominated. And if she keeps on doing things like she did in The Newsroom, I'm going to play golf or you're going to fuck her up.
Yeah, she's really eating the scenery in that show.
Because they're letting her do it. She's had a great career, and for a long time it was she had had, because she didn't act for a long time, but she's back doing things pretty regularly now, film and TV. But it could have been even greater, and I guess she just took a break because she was married to Ted Turner, and I don't think she would want to do the movie thing anymore so much. She was the workout person in the 80s, and that helped a lot of people. She made a lot of money doing it, too, but it helped a lot of people.
She gave all the money to causes, didn't she?
Oh, probably so. She's always been a cause person.
I think she used all the money she made from those videotapes to fund... I haven't seen the documentary, so I feel like I'm going to undersell this, and there's probably people listening who know exactly what this is and are very frustrated with me right now, but it was the anti-war stuff that she was involved in.
She was big-time anti-war. She was Hanoi Jane because she...
To fund the activism.
It sounded like she was pro-North Vietnamese, but she was not. She realizes the optics of Henry Fonda's daughter seeming, even just seeming, like she was pro-NVA was bad optics. But she's always had... a strong presence, or certainly since the early 70s, and I'll say it, this is a compliment to her, I think, a big mouth, and good for her.
But when she came back to acting, it didn't take long for her to regain all of her popularity. I'll never forget, a couple of years ago, she came to the Oscars, and she wore this beautiful white gown that was sequined and was just really classy, and she looked so beautiful. And this is a woman in her 80s. When my show that I work on did our end of the year special, we talked about who the most searched celebrity was the night of the Oscars, which look specifically, and it was her.
Jane Fonda.
Before every
in her 80s.
Other star that walked the Oscars red carpet that night, she wasn't even nominated for anything. She was presenting, and she still stood out that much. People love her. There is something about her that is so compelling. Part of it is, of course, her celebrity, her family, but I think a bigger part of it is just she has this incredible poise that draws you in, and there's just something about her that has this natural draw.
She's pretty likable, too, and she's played some tough characters, maybe even sometimes not the easiest to like, but I think generally she wins you over in her movies. And a movie like this, I think, right from the beginning, because she is the underdog. She is being objectified by all of them, which I guess every on-air person probably is. Women deal with it more than men. The thing that she deals with, as probably every woman does even now, maybe not as much the last couple of years since the Me Too thing started, is the anchor hitting on her. Not that what we see is that bad, but he's definitely hitting on her in the food line at one point. And then I think it's the next scene. It might be days later in reality. But in the next scene, she says that Pete is full of hot air. And as they go to the end credits, and you can't hear them anymore, but the end credit music, he's saying something like, I can't believe you said that to me on air. Well, it's just an innocent joke. I think you're the one full of hot air, Pete. Come on. But that's his ego that can't possibly be bruised. And he's probably... Well, we never see it in the movie, but undoubtedly people like this would have been slapping asses, and maybe far worse, even suggesting flat out, yeah, you want to get ahead, sleep with me.
And nobody in the 70s in her position would have gotten even as far as she has, which is not as far as she wants to go, but would have even had a position like she had unless she knew how to adeptly deal with dirtbags like that.
And she stumbles onto such a meaty story, which is not supposed to be. You said it earlier that it was just a fluff piece for nuclear power. And we see a Johnny the Explainer scene because we need it. But it also, for once, really makes sense because that would have been in the story for the sake of trying to just promote. And it is a promotion, if you think about what would have happened if this accident hadn't happened. A promotion for nuclear power.
Yeah, it's a PR stunt, the whole thing.
And then through the whole movie, she's a loyal company lady. She wants to do the right thing, but she also wants to be loyal to her network. And it's Douglas who's pushing her and pushing her. Which I think is actually maybe the most important thing in the whole film, that he, and to a lesser extent Hector, who aren't even working for the station, they're freelancing. So they are risking her job. Well, I guess it's her own choice. Yeah. She doesn't have to do
this.
They
have less to lose than she does, though.
Of course. And then she gets one of the most meaty stories of all time, including that great ending. We'll get to that in a few minutes. When the accident happens, one of the nice touches is ripples in the water, and there's also ripples in the coffee cup. And I guess maybe this was an homage, maybe it wasn't intentional, by Steven Spielberg in Jurassic Park, because we see ripples in the water when the T-Rex is coming.
And of course, it's the second ripple that only Jack Lemmon sees, which is the impetus for him to start doing a personal investigation into what's really going on. Jane Fonda is the main character, but Jack Goodell, played by Jack Lemmon, he just has such an interesting arc.
It's funny to think that Jack Lemmon's the guy, and yes, it was many years before, many decades before, was the guy with Billy Wilder where it's, what do you want? Nothing? And then Wilder would say, oh, please, God, meaning tone it down. It's too much Jack. And Jack Lemmon was pretty big a lot of the times, especially in the comedies. But in this, he is so wonderfully low-key. I love Nicholson, and he probably would have been fine because this is, well, he had done Cuckoo's Nest with Michael Douglas, and that's where he started going over the top. But after Cuckoo's Nest, he still did movies where he wasn't just being Jack. And I love the guy, but it's true. He started like Pacino with Injustice for All, and even Dog Day Afternoon to some degree with Pacino. giving it full volume all the time. But here's Lemon toning it down completely. So either James Bridges is an outstanding director, or Lemon in these drama movies like this, Glengarry Glen Ross Tribute, which I don't think I've ever seen before. He was nominated for that too. Lemon was nominated for 8 Oscars in his career.
Wow.
And he didn't get a nomination after, I think it was Tribute in 1980. So he worked for almost 20 more years and no more nominations. Should have been nominated for Glengarry Glen Ross, I think.
It reminds me of Robin Williams, who of course, every time he does comedy, is so over the top that sometimes it's overkill. Well, many people disagree
almost
with that.
Almost always overkill.
But when he, yeah, okay.
Like, in a good way a lot of the time, though.
But when he does drama, he's the complete opposite. I think of Good Will Hunting and just how understated and warm that performance is without losing his good humor. He still comes across with that lovability, but he could be so subtle when he needed to. And it's the same with Jack Lemmon. Those subtle touches. If he was overreacting, the film would have actually lost some of its urgency because it would have just felt like a drama. They need to convince us this is important, which means that they're trying to force it on us. But it's the silence, it's the stillness, it's that they all go into freeze mode.
Because what else can you do? They pump water in there, they can't go down there. Do you want to go down there and pump it by hand?
But it's scary, the seriousness with which they're treating it. They're not just afraid that they're going to lose control of the plant or that they're going to lose their jobs. They're going to lose their lives, and they could be responsible for killing tens of millions of people.
And his co-worker and friend, Wilford Brimley, Ted Spindler, one of Brimley's best performances, Chris and I just covered him last week in The Natural, where we said he's the best thing in that, and that's in a movie with Robert Redford and Robert Duvall. And even good actors like Glenn Close, for that matter. She's got a smaller role. Brimley has a lot more screen time. But he's terrific in that film. He's terrific in this movie. We liked him in The Thing. Of course, the Quaker Oats guy and the diabetes guy. But he's so strong in this movie, and his statement towards the end, where they're trying to get him to shut up, because first it is the company giving their statement through Gibson, and it's just completely throwing Jack Adell under the bus. Of course they would. They just shot him in the back for crying out loud. And I'd forgotten. I hadn't seen this movie in a few weeks, and I watched it late at night when I wasn't paying much attention to it, I guess, because I know I've seen it within the last few months. But I didn't remember at the end that the TV cameras weren't shooting anymore because Goodell is going so long in that explanation. They're literally cut off because the SWAT guys cut the cables, so they're not on the air anymore. So I always thought that he got shot on camera, but he's not, so they could spin the story however they want to. In the end, Spindler's the one who says, "No!" And when they're trying to make him stop, "My friend was a hero. He wasn't wrong. He wasn't insane. There'll be an investigation this time." And it's probably Ted's statement that would ensure that more than anything else.
Yeah, you're right. That's
because
really
Kimberly can say whatever she wants to as a witness, and maybe people would have believed a journalist, but she's also a woman, and people would have said, "Well, she's just a flaky chick. Who knows what she saw?"
Or she's a journalist. She's just trying to sensationalize
fake news.
When Kimberly, who is a consummate professional, dedicated to her job and her integrity as a journalist, she's on camera, and she loses her composure, drops her journalistic objectivity, and starts crying. I can't praise her performance enough. It's just so genuine and beautiful, and your heart breaks with her completely. Between her performance and, of course, the script and the direction, it's a really deeply earned moment.
She only shares a few scenes with Lemon, and they are co-leads, effectively. She has more scenes with Michael Douglas, but he wasn't an acting star at this point. He'd been a producer, but people didn't know about producers. They knew he won the Oscar maybe 4 years before this. So really, it is Fonda and Lemon who are huge names going into this film and obviously coming out of it. But they only have a few scenes together. The one in the bar when they first meet. I don't know if they have, well, maybe in his house, I guess. And then, of course, at the very end, when he is taking too long to explain everything and everybody gets his story across. So in a way, it's only through what Ted would probably say and what Kimberly says in that report and maybe other times. And maybe they'd interview people like Richard, which is the Michael Douglas character. One of the things in this movie, by the way, when you talk about the plant being irresponsible, is they go after Hector and run him off the road. And my question for that is, he's driving a sports car. They're in a van. Why can't he outrun them?
Isn't that parallel to the story in Silkwood? Which is about a real activist, a whistleblower, I should say, who died mysteriously in a car accident.
Oh, yeah? Meryl Streep plays her, doesn't she?
Yes. But it's a true story. They can't prove anything, but the assumption is that she was driven off the road. Because people are very invested in saving their own asses.
But I'm just saying that's one high-powered van.
Okay, yes, you're right. Reasonably
although Hector probably doesn't believe that they're going to do it to him until it's too late and he is being run off the road. He doesn't die, at least. The jaws of life save him. He's okay.
But they do get the falsified x-rays that prove that the plant was shirking their duties of safety procedures.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the opening of the movie happens and Douglas is filming illegally, why it's illegal, I'm guessing, I don't know if they even say so, it'd be safeguarding against the Russians.
I mean, that makes sense. That's a good reason not to let people film in a nuclear power plant.
And then when they get back and they find out that the plant people realize what they were doing, it's Don Jakovich who's being a responsible journalist. He doesn't want to sensationalize this by putting it on the air when they're not ready. They don't need to put it on that night. It just happened. Nothing actually did happen that they're aware of, at least. So let's find out the facts of this. But then as it goes on, he's not so responsible. He's burying the story because he's being pressured too. As you said, this really is more of a media TV news story than it is a nuclear power plant story.
And it's a story about the banality of evil, that we are truly in far more danger from the whims of an arrogant bureaucrat trying to cover their own tracks to protect themselves from consequences than we are from any violent madman like Jack Goodell.
I like when he takes the gun from the security guard who's so wimpy. Although the guy probably never would have been actually prepared. He's a bit of a token, I suppose. Had something happen in the room where he needs to take care of it and maybe pull his gun, maybe that's why he's there in the first place rather than somebody going up behind him. And a guy he probably knew and trusted who's certainly not somebody he had to worry about. A guy who seems to be a Navy man. Somebody in the military, as Jack Goodell was. Because Ted says, I'm a company man. The rest of you guys are all, was it Navy, I think? But definitely military guys.
Yeah, we never really learned that much about Jack outside of his job. We're told that his job is his life. It is then curious when we see his home, and there is a parallel scene to the scene where we see Kimberly's home. You said it won the Oscar for production design?
No, it was nominated for
the sets. Nominated for production design, which is really unusual for any contemporary film. But I can see where between the reality of the nuclear power plant, but also these scenes where you have Kimberly going home to what it seems like a bachelor pad.
Her turtle.
Her pet turtle. Even having an idiosyncrasy like that, she has a half-size fridge. She's the home of somebody who's never home. It's messy. Nothing really looks that pretty. This is the home of a busy bachelor.
She's always doing something about her career.
Yeah, you see countless male characters having a home like this, and it actually is this radical thing to see a female character live in a house like this. Jack Goodell, on the other hand, it does not look like the home of a bachelor. This is a well-loved suburban family home. So it begs the question, he lives alone. Is he a widow? I honestly think that's what the film is implying without telling you. Because even if he were divorced, I don't think he would have gone head-to-head with the lawyers fighting over things like macrame, plant hangers, all those little homey touches that are in that house, or on that set, I should say. I think there was a lot of very deliberate choices made by the production designer to give us some insight into the real reason he's married to his job, but he still has this moral compass that makes it necessary for him to do the right thing. He's married to his job because he's lonely, because he's lost whatever made his house a home. I'm kind of inferring here, and somebody could tell me that I'm dead wrong, but I really think that's what they were trying to convey.
I think it's a good insight, and you may be very right. It's also interesting that Ted says in that last scene, he was my best friend. And we don't really see evidence of them being best friends.
No, it's true. As a matter of fact, when it looks like Ted is the one being thrown under the bus, you don't get the impression that Jack is that upset about it until Ted says to his face, they questioned me for 7 hours. They're trying to make me the patsy for this.
There's a really nice touch in this movie because more than once we go to a protest about nuclear power. And there's three people that are wearing blindfolds, and that's their whole point. One of the guys speaks for them for a little bit to set it up, and then they're going to put a gag on their mouths, and the guy who sets it up actually joins them in the little protest. And I guess the rest of their time is just standing there staring at them and not saying anything. And wouldn't it be funny, as soon as they took those gags off and as they walk back to their seats, because it's a big wide shot, if we saw them all talking, the instant they took it off, oh my God, that was really cool, we just did, huh? Oh, we really showed those guys. They don't do that, but it would have been funny if they had. Anyway, back to the serious stuff. So when Jack is driving up quickly to the plant in the climax, and we really get more of him for a little while here, one of the guards at the front gate says he could get himself shot driving up here like that. And of course, that's what happens to him. He gets himself shot by the SWAT guys in the climax of the film. He does seem like a crazy man. Obviously, you can understand why they would think so at the security gate. And then all of his friends and coworkers would probably think the same thing of him as well. They're trying to, what they say, scram him. His own friends, who are being company men, I don't really blame them. But they're trying to fake him out because even after he's been shot, he's still trying to flip switches to prevent what he thinks is a meltdown. But they're just faking him out, including Ted. And I don't blame those guys, but I love the diligence. The Goodell's been shot in the back and still, no, I gotta stop this from happening.
Well, when you consider, again, the consequences of what would happen if a madman really did wreak havoc in that room, no matter how much you love somebody, no matter how close of friends you are with somebody, you have to value the safety of everybody who relies on the power plant to not go into meltdown more than your friendship with that person.
And it's one of those movies that portray the media as the good guy because they're going to do the right thing and tell the real story versus what happens so often and what happened before this. Network is a great example of a movie that's showing the media being bad guys, mostly. by irresponsibly putting a crazy man on the air who shouldn't be doing this anymore and then profiting from it.
And by amplifying terrorist groups and just doing everything to boost their ratings and never really giving a damn about the moral reasons that they might be journalists in the first place.
And the last thing in this movie is a commercial, and it shows a microwave oven, which has to be a deliberate touch, of course, too. You need the power for that, power for the TV people to give us TV in the first place, and for the plant to work itself. It's this vicious circle of the power plant, because it uses a lot of power. I don't know if a power plant actually uses nuclear power to run itself.
Good question.
It probably should, shouldn't it?
Yeah. It is a pretty chilling touch, actually, that it ends the way it does, with the control room, and it plays the commercial. The TV show still has to go to break. They still have to run commercials. They still have to carry on, and this is, in a big way, just another story to them.
Well, the guy telling this story is James Bridges. He only directed 8 movies because he died at 57. He did The Paper Chase before this and Urban Cowboy after it. We probably won't cover another James Bridges movie. And this is not a relation to Jeff and Beau Bridges, I don't believe. Just a coincidental last name. He's got a really slow build, big thrills at times. The opening sequence, not opening, I guess, but when we see the accident almost happen. Because nothing really actually happens, it just comes close. And then the simmering tension of the second act until the end. When we also know that one of those machines is faulty. They show it revving up as high as it can go. They overrun it deliberately, and it starts to fall apart. So there are actual concerns with that piece of equipment. But we got this whole tension, and you've got the SWAT guys. It's great cutting, actually. The SWAT guys going to the power plant, the media guys, Michael Douglas and whatnot, going into the power plant. We see what's happening at the TV station, and then Kimberly and Jack in the main room. But the SWAT guys are very quietly and discreetly trying to get in there with blowtorches so they can take their guns in there and just shoot him dead. As they're going to scram the son of a bitch, fake him out, and then shoot the son of a bitch. I think Bridges, Mike Gray, and T.S. Cook wrote a really good screenplay. Like I said, it was nominated for the Oscar, and it won the WGA. Gray only wrote 3 scripts in total, and this was the only movie for T.S. Cook. He did a lot of TV. So it's a shame that these guys didn't do more movies, because they did a hell of a good job. I don't know if Jane Fonda ever used them again, and I don't know any stories about maybe there's problems. You know, sometimes when you see people that don't work anymore, it could be that they died. I don't think that any of these people did. Bridges died early, but not this early. Or it could just been that Fonda moved on to other people.
Yeah, it could be lightning in a bottle. Maybe they were a team that worked together amazing. Maybe Bridges is a better director than people want to give him credit for, and he cleaned up a script that had good ideas but didn't really have a cohesive plot, and he cleaned those elements up. Maybe it was the actors who were feeding lines that were extra clever and poignant. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things that can go into a script and a production to make a good script great, although it is pretty hard to believe that this script didn't start off with some really good bones, because the story is so well structured. There's no fat to trim. There's characters like Michael Douglas's character, who's just really there to serve a purpose and get the plot moving along, but he still feels like a real person, an interesting person. As soon as he overstays his welcome, he kind of gets out of the way for the main event to happen. It's just so interesting. It's so layered. The dialogue is also really clever. There's just so many good lines in the film as well.
Fonda didn't work that many more years after this. She started making fewer films and then none altogether around 1990. But it's a shame that neither she and Lemon, or she and Douglas, or Douglas and Lemon worked together again. If they did, I can't think of a project. Lemon was around for another 20 years or so. I think his last movie was in 2000. And really big kudos to Bridges for getting such a performance out of a guy who could be hammy. As great as he was in Some Like It Hot, a movie that I wasn't a huge fan of, but the more I think about it, and I haven't seen it again in a while, one of the great comic performances of all time is Jack Lemmon. But then he could take it too far, way too often. In this movie, I can't think of a moment. They always say, no false notes. I can't think of a false note in this performance.
As we've talked about Lemmon before, you know, we always have to say he is just one of the most winning, lovable people to ever grace the screen. He has a Tom Hanks quality where it's really impossible not to root for him. He just is pathos personified.
And you should click on his link and look at all the movies he made if you can't think of all the ones. We've mentioned a bunch of them as it is, but he had one hell of a career. As has Michael Douglas, for that matter, whether you like him or not, and Jane Fonda, too. All 3 of these actors all won 2 Oscars apiece. Lemmon, 2 for acting, Fonda, 2 for acting, and Douglas for producing once and acting once. Okay, the movie's 185-1. We watched the DVD, which I thought was okay. The cinematographer, James, I think it's pronounced Crabe. We did him on Rocky a long time ago, and also The Karate Kid, Chris and I covered last year. He also died fairly young, 1989. So only about 10 more years after this movie. I guess it was 10 years after this movie. And the movie doesn't look all that great. It doesn't really need to. It's supposed to be more of a bright light kind of thing. I did notice, actually, that they have a lot of green in there as a tint.
Fluorescence.
Yeah, I guess you could argue that, but do fluorescents look that green?
They do when you first walk in a room. It gives you the impression of a workplace.
It seems more of an effect than in reality. But for the most part, this movie just looks pretty real. It's almost like a documentary style.
It's like the color you would associate with nuclear power.
Oh, of course, yeah. Nice green glow.
But yeah, you're right. It has a documentary style, which is perfectly appropriate. It doesn't have the prettiest look. It's not a beautiful film, but it shouldn't be either. It should just feel like you're there. It should feel realistic.
Network is the same. They both benefit from that. The editor, David Rawlins, who did a really good job in this movie, also cut Saturday Night Fever, which we covered a couple years ago, but mostly worked on comedies, so that's interesting. Saturday Night Fever is kind of a dance film, but mostly a drama. This is deadly serious drama, but mostly comedies.
But, okay, I will say this. Comedies rely on having good timing. You have to have perfect dramatic timing to edit a comedy, and that, of course, is going to translate well into a thriller or into a music film like Saturday Night Fever.
We already said there's no music at any point in this movie, just the diegetic pop songs, including off the jukebox. What do you think of the look, the cutting, and the fact there's no music? I think you like that.
I think technically it's unimpeachable. There is no soundtrack, which I love. There was a score that was composed by Michael Small, but they chose to drop it and just go with the natural soundtrack. There is one notably terrible bit of canned music in a party scene with this really cheesy late-era disco. Oh, it's just awful, but for the most part, again, has a documentary feel or like a newscast feel. Way scarier, way more tense for not having music to tell you how to feel, for not having hyperbolic performances to tell you how you should be feeling. The realism itself is so much more chilling.
When Lemon taps on that valve and it starts plummeting because it was just stuck.
Don't you feel it? I felt it.
So many movies would have it be some kind of music stinger. Didn't need a music stinger.
No, you did not need it. It was so effective.
And we didn't know what exactly that valve was because the explainer thing with Gibson earlier had nothing to do with that. But you can put two and two together unless you're an idiot. And I think most people put two and two together with this movie pretty quickly. And also the way the guys react. So even if for some reason you're lost at that point, the fact that Lemon and Brimley and the other guys are all just so quietly tense, that very quiet panic, we can't do anything else. The water's coming back up. We're going to be okay. They did all they could.
They draw that moment out,
there's a point where they are as helpless as anybody else because they've already done all they can. And it isn't really their fault any of this happened. This is the risk of such a vicious power source. If it goes wrong, solar's not going to do this to us. I'm such a hippie and a liberal.
I know. The older we get, the more...
At least do something with it. Why isn't this house powered by solar panels as much as possible? At least reduce what we need from a power plant or from Niagara Falls or whatever. Okay, we mentioned Chernobyl on TV. We've been watching that. We've only seen two of the, I think, six episodes so far. We might watch one tonight. Pretty powerful stuff. And also, around this same time, this was part of a wave of nuclear power and nuclear weapons movies in the early to mid-80s. Sometimes those things happen where there's no one reason why you see all kinds of movies that come out around that same time about a topic. But this was the late 70s, early 80s nuclear phase.
People were still worried about the Cold War. When Reagan was president, I remember this as a little girl, people talking about the fear of the nuclear war and just fear of nuclear disaster. It's an incredible power that we had in our hands and obviously hasn't always been wielded
responsibly.
Yeah, you're right. I'm against it, guys. We're partially powered by nuclear power. There's a plant not far from Toronto in a town called Pickering that we get some of our power from.
We were right near it last night because our friends live in Scarborough.
And they have been administered iodine pills. The government passed them out. Just maybe keep them in your cupboard. Just some iodine pills for no reason in particular. Don't worry. Just look away. Here you go. Anyway.
That plan is one reason why this area might be targeted by the Russians if they ever decide to attack, or if America ever decides to attack Canada because of the nuclear power plant not too far outside this city. All right. Last thoughts on a really terrific thriller, The China, or should I say The Madagascar Syndrome.
I guess this film's gotten buried because of its tonal similarities to All the President's Men or Network, or like you said, all the other films about nuclear disasters that came out around the same time, just thrown in with all the nuclear panic that was in the air at the time. But it is a gem, a must watch for any Jane Fonda or Jack Lemmon fans, and a sound piece of evidence against movie scores.
Yeah, it's an excellent thriller. The performances are terrific. I think Douglas, too, but certainly Lemon and Fonda, who are outstanding. And it's so believable. It feels like this is something that was actually filmed and it got loose. Okay, when we return in 7 days, we'll be covering another one of Quentin Tarantino's flicks. We've done a bunch of them. They've usually been pretty popular when we release those. His Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is coming out July 26th. So this is the perfect time to go back 10 years and take another look at Inglourious Basterds. The Bastards. So many people in that movie who either were big stars like Mike Myers in a small role or have become big players like Michael Fassbender, who we didn't either know then or don't have a big role in it, like Myers or Rod Taylor, who's also playing Churchill in that scene with Myers. But of course, that'll be a big topic next week. So the coming attractions trivia for Inglourious Basterds. Not counting laughing, grunting, or screaming, what are the last words of Colonel Landa, Adolf Hitler, and Lieutenant Rain?
Okay, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Inglourious Basterds. But what if you can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. You can also subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case-sensitive.
Nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear.
Thank you, Homer.
And cut.